Hey, Dan here. Dear listener, if you enjoy 40 Minutes in the Old Testament, I'm guessing that you would enjoy some of the other things we have going on at the new ChristHoldFast.org. We have a new article up every morning, Monday through Friday. We have 5 podcasts, a video cast, and we're doing a conference in February. There's other things we want to do, and all of this takes an enormous amount of time. All of this content is free, but we do need to be able to hire somebody to help us manage it, to get it out on time, and to keep the quality high. If these resources have been helpful to you, please consider going to Christ Hold Fast and clicking on the support page. There you can make a one-time donation or a reoccurring donation of any size. This will help us meet our goals of being able to bring someone on staff. Everyone at Christ Hold Fast would greatly appreciate your support. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. Thank you for joining us again. I am Daniel Henry Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird and Brandon Hansen. How you guys doing?
Hey, we're good. We're good. Glad to be back.
Yeah, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is there.
Yes. Real quick note, if you are listening to this and you have not been over to ChristHoldFast.org, and if you haven't went there and then navigated yourself to the conference page, and then in doing so haven't clicked that register button, you should probably shut this down and do that, and then come back to this. Or if you could listen to this while you register to the conference, and that would be the best of all things. I would recommend you do that. So go check that out, because all three of us, in fact, will be doing different things at that event. And so I know Chad is—he really wants you guys to come. He wants.
I do. I do. We got these early bird devotions with Chad Bird. So you gotta be there.
You gotta be
there. Cup of coffee in hand, whether you're awake or asleep, it doesn't matter. You need to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it won't be just us. We're small potatoes on this whole event. We've got a ridiculous list of speakers who have agreed to come out and are excited to participate. So you can go check out that list. You can register there. You can see what exactly is going to be going on. Lots of people that we've had on the Christel Fastcast are going to be there. And so check that out. Chad, where are we in this whole Old Testament journey?
Well, last time we left off with laughter, the laughter story in Genesis 18, and we're going to pick up today with a story that doesn't have laughter in it, that's not humorous. But we're about halfway through chapter 18 in Genesis, and we're going to transition to the whole story about Sodom and Gomorrah today. That's where this account begins. We've got the last half of chapter 18, and then we have all of chapter 19 that are concerned with this story. So we'll probably be here for at least a couple of episodes. But last time, just to kind of provide the context here, we talked about when these three mysterious visitors came to Abraham and Sarah's tent when they were camped there at the Oaks of Mamre, and this is the final announcement. The definitive announcement that Sarah is going to have a son, and that his name will be Isaac. We've had this promise for the last 25 years, reiterated multiple times, but finally the Lord actually appears along with two angels, and they have a meal with Abraham, and they promise Abraham that he's going to come back. The Lord is going to come back the same time next year, and Sarah will have a child. And when Sarah hears it, she's eavesdropping in the tent behind the men. When she hears it, she laughs, because the promise seems so outrageous, so comical, so hilarious, because she's 90 years old, that she laughs in kind of a combination of unbelief and delight all at the same time. And that's where we stopped last time, Genesis 18:15. So we'll move on from there. if you guys are ready.
Dude, I'm ready.
All right, let's do it.
Brandon, he looks ready.
Brandon is ready.
He looks ready.
Yeah.
Locked, cocked, and ready to go.
I can see
whatever that means.
Anticipation all over his face.
I'm always ready for Sodom and Gomorrah. Let's do it.
All right, let's go. All right, so here's what happened next. We leave off from the whole camp and the laughter scene, and we pick up with the story in verse 16. It says, the men, talking about the these three mysterious men, one of whom was the Lord, the men rose up from there, and they looked down toward Sodom. And Abraham was walking with them to send them off. And God poses this question, just kind of a thinking out loud kind of question. He says, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? Since Abraham will become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And he goes on to talk about how he's chosen Abraham, that Abraham may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice. So God poses this question. He reflects upon the fact that he's chosen Abraham. Abraham is going to be the one through whom the promised seed will come. And in asking the question in this way, of course, the Lord gives his own answer. Yes. Yes, he will. He will disclose to Abraham what he's about to do. Now, the question, as I was reading this and pondering upon the Lord's question, the question I ask myself is, why does God speak in this way? Why does he say, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? What he's about to do, of course, is to announce an impending destruction upon Sodom and Gomorrah. So why would the Lord not hide? Why would he disclose what he's about to do to Abraham? Lot is evidently very important to Abraham. Lot is the son of Abraham's deceased brother. So Abraham has more or less adopted Lot as his own son. When he leaves his home country, he takes Lot with him. So Lot and Sarah and Abraham all make this journey. And even though they separate at one point because their herdsmen were at odds with each other because there wasn't enough land, Abraham has remained faithful to Lot through all these years. In fact, I want to talk about this in just a minute. You know, there's a point where Abraham actually rescues Lot after he's been kidnapped. So yeah, Lot is loved by Abraham. He's his nephew, sort of his adopted son. And so because of that, God wants to let Abraham know, hey, this is what's about to happen. And Lot is down there. So I'm going to inform you of my plan. I wonder too, and maybe this is speculation, but I wonder too if this is something of a test for Abraham. If God is disclosing this to Abraham to see how Abraham reacts. Will Abraham simply accept this decreed judgment of God, or will he act in a way that is in concert with mercy and grace and concern for others? In other words, when God tells Abraham this, will Abraham simply stand aside and say, all right, you know, that's what you want to do, well, blow him to smithereens? Or will Abraham actually stand in front of God and act as an intercessor? Will he plead for mercy, not just for Lot, but for the entire city?
Yeah, that is one thing that, well, we haven't got there yet, but that will play out is he doesn't just fight for Lot. Try to persuade God for the sake of Lot alone, but for the sake of whoever is there that could be worth saving, and maybe perhaps in Abraham's mind, as a pretty rank sinner himself. Sinners happen to, I've noticed this, people that, Abraham has got himself a record people with records are a little sympathetic to other people with records, and they sometimes will go and take up their cause, try to see if they can garner them some mercy. And this is a regular thing within scripture, just within life, where a dude that has not come to grips with his own record and sort of his own failure, he's not interested in mercy at all. And that's usually how it goes. You know, I'm not going to Nineveh. Nah, I'm not doing that because I'm a pretty righteous dude. And those people deserve what they get. But you see people that have like really ate it sometimes are a little more soft.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the reasons that the Lord allows us to have these downfalls, to experience being broken, is because it does seem to work that way. That the more that a person is aware of their own sinfulness and depravity, the more they are aware of, even if others are not, the more that they themselves are aware of their own weaknesses and failings and the temptations to which they have succumbed. Generally speaking, the much more mercy they're going to have on those who are in the same situation. Whereas the higher opinion I have of myself, the lower opinion I'm going to have of other people. And Abraham, like you say, he's got a history. His resume is not spotless. Well, way back in chapter 12, when we first started talking about him, he basically used his wife as a means whereby to save his own life. You know, he hands her over more or less to the Egyptians, and she ends up caught in a situation of adultery just so that Abraham can spare his own life. So he's got his problems, and that's probably one of the reasons why he's wanting to act in as a merciful intercessor for Sodom and Gomorrah.
Yeah, there's nothing like God saying to Abraham, "So Abraham, there's a lot of sexual immorality going on down there in Sodom. I was thinking about destroying the whole thing. What do you think?" Is that what we do with sexual immorality? Like, is that what happens?
Yeah. His response, the way that he, and this is probably, at least in my eyes, the most incredible prayer in the scriptures. That's why he begins to pray the way he does. So let's get to that prayer in just a minute. Before we do, though, there is a couple of verses here that I think are worthy of note. I'm looking at verse 20 now. It says, "The Lord said, 'The outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know.'" This is the second time in Genesis that we've heard about how bad a place Sodom and Gomorrah is. We heard about it first, actually, all the way back in chapter 13. I'm looking at chapter 13, verse 13. It says, "Now the men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners against the Lord." And that's all it tells us. And now we hear, all the way here in chapter 18, that the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. But all we have right now are these kind of general pronouncements of the wicked nature of the people of Sodom, without any specifics whatsoever. We're going to find out as the story goes on at least one example of that sinfulness or of that wickedness. But I think I'm going to save discussion of that until we actually get to that point. So we have the Lord saying that, and then he says he's going to go down and find out if the report is true. Then kind of have a shift in the narrative. It says, remember there were these three men, which at least I think are the Lord and two angels. It says, the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. So now we got this split that takes place. We got these two so-called men that will be called angels at the beginning of chapter 19. They go on this this mission to Sodom and Gomorrah while the Lord stays behind with Abraham. And this is when we begin to have this this long petition, intercession by Abraham. He starts out with a question himself. The Lord had asked, shall I indeed hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? And so Abraham, once he's heard, he has a question of his own. He says, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there's 50 righteous within the city. Will you sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? So what do you think Abraham is up to? And this is just the beginning of the prayer, but what are some of the assumptions that Abraham makes about God that are the basis of his intercession for the city of Sodom?
God is just, that perhaps God sees a difference in men between righteousness and wickedness.
I think it's pretty obvious that that Abraham, being an unrighteous man himself, who is in fact righteous, does have a pretty good grasp on the concept of alien righteousness. So I don't think he's in any way saying, what if there's some dudes that are not sinners down there with those dudes that are sinners? What if that's the case? I don't think he's making that argument, but I do think he's saying, what if there are men of faith? What if there are some of those down there? What if there's some men like me down there? I certainly don't think he's arguing for a righteousness of your own. And what about those guys down there? He surely knows better at this point in his own life. And only then can he appeal to the justice of God, because clearly he would know that, God has destroyed all of creation once before. And so he's appealing to something else besides that.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful to reflect upon the fact that there's two kinds of righteousness that the scriptures often talk about. And you could think of these in terms of horizontal righteousness and vertical righteousness. Horizontal righteousness is kind of the righteousness that we see when we're looking at others. Like I might know a guy and I say, he's a good person, he's a righteous person, he is active in loving his neighbors. So that's the horizontal righteousness, which of course differs from person to person. Everybody's unique in that respect. But that has nothing to do with the other kind of righteousness, and that is the vertical righteousness. And vertical righteousness is that which God gives to us from Jesus Christ. It's the righteousness which he declares to us, imputes to us, gives to us, so that it's an alien righteousness, like you mentioned earlier, Dan. Alien in the sense that it's not ours. It's the righteousness of Christ, which God the Father gives to us by grace. And this righteousness is a perfect righteousness. It's that which we receive by faith.
If you look at Lot's life, and spoiler alert here for anybody who hasn't seen this movie yet, I think of Genesis as a movie now. Lot is not the most righteous guy on the face of the earth. I mean, maybe we don't know so much about him yet, but it turns out that he has some pretty inappropriate relationships with his daughters just after this, not too long after this. So he definitely is not saved because of his horizontal righteousness or some righteousness within him. So I guess I would like to go back and amend what I said. I wasn't thinking quite clearly there. It could have sounded incorrect there, but I guess kind of what I think one of the presuppositions that Abraham is approaching God here with then is that God is both just and the justifier of the ungodly. And it is that alien righteousness that he's hoping God is seeing there through faith.
What's wild is, and we'll get there obviously, is that in the New Testament you do have Lot. You have Peter talking about Lot, and he says his righteous soul, and you're like, okay, well, that's weird because I see like basically zero things in Lot's life that are righteous. Like, no joke, there's not a lot in Scripture about Lot. And, like, none of it is, like, something that you'd be like, that is righteous. Look at that righteousness. Like, not one freaking thing, man. Like, that. If Peter didn't say Lot was righteous, it would be, like, church history would probably be like, oh, no, Lot's burning in hell for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be completely honest here. I really don't get that that section of 2 Peter. It says that, it talks about righteous Lot. He was oppressed by the sensual conduct of unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day with their lawless deeds.
It doesn't read like that, does it?
No, I don't mean to come across as if I'm denying this or contradicting this. I'm just simply being quite honest in that I have a hard time, I guess, understanding where Peter is coming from. Simply because if you read the narrative, if you read Genesis 18 and 19, Lot comes out as pretty much of a jerk, and he doesn't even want to leave Sodom, even after everything that happens during this horrific night, and the angels are telling him God's going to destroy the city. He delays. There's this one verse in chapter 19 where it says Lot tarries, or he dawdles. And so the angels basically have to drag him out of the city.
Yeah.
And he chose to live there. It's not like he was, you know, kept there. He chose to live in Sodom.
Well, I think it's an example of, I think you got some simul going on. And here's the fact is, you can be up to your eyeballs in sin and be intentionally up to your eyeballs in sin. You can move to Sodom. You can pitch your tent near Sodom. That's what Lot does. You can mm-hmm. straight up build your house in the town square. And you can do all those things. And there can be part of you that is miserable the whole time. And that's just the way of it with sin. And everything on the outside, everything externally, as if someone was to write it down, would say this guy's, he's loving it, he's doing it on purpose, he's there by his own choosing. This guy's a dirtbag. But apparently, so it is with Lot. There was at least something, and in this case, Peter calls it that his righteous soul. And we know for sure we're talking about alien righteousness here, because there ain't any. There's no horizontal righteousness going on here. That there's that thing in him, that new man in him, which apparently is there for Lot, is tormented and miserable the whole time. But the old man is quite happy and quite content. And at that, in this instance, in Sodom and Gomorrah, that old man has his little time of victory as Lot pitches his tent in Sodom and hangs out there, decides he's going to raise his family in this horrible place, and he's going to he's dilly-dallying with the angels and all this. Sin is a crazy thing. You can do all kinds of things and continue doing all kinds of things and just be absolutely miserable at the same time. You can be, I mean, like, the struggle is real, y'all. All right? Like you can be, like, loving it and hating it at the same time. I mean, this is what Paul talks about. Like, you can be loving living in Sodom and hate living in Sodom at the same exact time.
Yeah, I think that's the contradiction that we all live with. And day to day, hour to hour, it changes. Sometimes we're miserable, sometimes we're loving it. And sometimes it's all happening. It's all happening at once. All right, so maybe we're much more like Lot than we would ever care to admit. There's a reason why the scriptures go on to use Sodom as kind of an emblem of the world, not of the, you know, one segment of the world, some sin city or some extremely wicked country, but as the world, because that's where we live. We're in Sodom, and we're sojourners, just like Lot was, actually, because our country is elsewhere, but we're still living here. We're still surrounded by people that are that are going to draw us into wickedness, and we struggle with the wickedness that's within us.
Yep. We've, like, jumped way ahead of ourselves here, I think.
Yeah. We did need to give a spoiler alert for those who haven't seen this movie.
Sorry.
Oh, it's fine. It's good. We're not restricted to a linear approach here. We can jump ahead. So I guess let's talk a little bit more about this prayer. Abraham starts out by saying, hey, look, God, you're just, you're righteous. And I know that you're not going to simply sweep away the righteous with the wicked. So suppose there's 50 righteous people in the city. And God responds. He says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. Now, speaking personally here, if I would have had the audacity to intercede in this way with God, I probably would have stopped there, because I know myself. I was like, okay, well, maybe there'll be 50 there, but Abraham doesn't. This is actually only the beginning. He goes on. He says, well, this is verse 27. Look, I've ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Will you destroy the whole city because of 5? And God said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And then he goes on. He says, Abraham spoke to him yet again. He says, well, suppose 40 are found there. And once more, God says, I won't do it on account of the 40. And Abraham's still not finished. He says, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he says, I won't do it if I find 30 there. And still Abraham goes on. He says, behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. God says, I won't destroy it on account of the 20. And then finally, Abraham says, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. What do you think this tells us about prayer?
Abraham is approaching this in a very, it's humble. It kind of reminds me of the first part of Romans 2, where it says, do not presuming on the riches and kindness and forbearance of God, his patience. And I think Abraham here, is what he's doing is he's not presuming on it, but he's testing the mercy of God. He's testing God's patience. How far can I push this? How deep and wide, how great is the depth and breadth of God's mercy here? I'll tread carefully here. He knows that there's not too many righteous people down there. There's not too many people of faith. And, And he wants to get down to the lowest denominator possible, but he also realizes he's in the presence of the Lord Almighty, the creator of the heavens and the earth, and it's not a good thing to just simply assume things about God that you don't know for certain.
Yeah, there's almost like a combination of audacity,
yeah,
and humility. Both in this prayer. I mean, more than once he says something which acknowledges his own lowliness, his own unworthiness to say what he's saying. He early on he says, you know, I am but dust and ashes, so I'm nothing. You know, I'm not approaching you because I'm righteous. I'm not approaching you because I have some sort of pull with you. All I am is dust and ashes. And he asked God more than once, you know, don't get mad, don't get angry. So there's this acknowledgement of his unworthiness to speak to God. But combined with that is this boldness, this audacity in prayer to go on and on and to push the envelope farther and farther until he finally gets to 10 righteous people.
It's an awesome truth that the throne of grace is this kind of place that even dust and ashes may approach it boldly, which says something about God, that when you're approaching the grace of God, though you be just dust and ashes, and that's certainly true, that even dust and ashes can approach that throne with some boldness. Boldness is not the opposite of humility. That would be pride. He's not approaching it pridefully at all, but he's approaching it boldly because while he doesn't know everything about God, he certainly has lived long enough, ate crap enough times, to know that this is true of God, that the throne of grace is a place that he can safely go, and he can have some measure of boldness in approaching it. He's been there before, and Abraham is no stranger to the grace of God, and so he has a humble confidence in walking up to that throne and saying, I have a request that I would make upon the grace of God. And though dust and ashes I be, I know that this is a safe place for me to make that request, which says something awesome about God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If anyone knows that God is a merciful God, it's Abraham, and it's exclusively upon the knowledge of that mercy that Abraham is able to say what he does. He doesn't approach him saying, you owe this to me. He doesn't approach him saying, because I'm righteous, I expect you to listen to me. He approaches him because he knows that he's a gracious and merciful God. You could almost make the claim that every psalm that's written in some way is inspired by this dialogue between Abraham and the Lord, because the Psalms are full of brutally honest prayers in which people take God to task. They call upon him in complete humility, but also complete confidence that he will hear them, even when they say seemingly outlandish things. They're honest in their prayers. They don't feel like they have to in some way make excuses, because they trust that he is a merciful and a gracious Father, which is the confidence that we have as we approach God's throne of grace too. You know, if God was willing to look upon this world in mercy, to send his Son to live the life that he did, to suffer at the hands of men, to be crucified, to endure this ignominious death on our behalf, and to be buried and to be raised to life again. If God is so merciful as to do all of this for us, despite the fact that we didn't didn't even want it, much less deserve it. And certainly, he is going to be merciful and gracious in listening to us as we talk to him, in accepting our prayers as prayers which are coming to him through the sacrifice of Christ and are heard and are answered by him. That's the means by which we approach prayer today. The same thing that that Abraham had way back in Genesis 18.
Can I just bring up another thing that I just thought of this, and this goes all the way back almost to the beginning of the passage here, but it kind of encompasses this whole thing here, is God's two words of law and gospel. Another way to talk about them is God's proper word and God's alien word. That his proper word is his word of provision, of protection, of care, of love and mercy, and of promise. For future hope. The word of Christ and the promises is the way that the confessions talk about it, and it's shorthand is the gospel. So we've got law and gospel here, and I think when I'm going to go back and answer your first question, what is God doing here when he's asking, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do, since Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed? Why would God ask this? I'm going to venture to say that he's wrestling within himself that this is an alien word he's about to pronounce, a word of judgment. It's not God's proper word to judge his creation, which he first called very good, and which has, of course, since fallen into sin and depravity. But it's something that must be done, and it's something that God doesn't turn away from doing. But I think we see here the heart of God, that it is not his it is not the word that he prefers to speak here, this word of judgment that he's about to pronounce. It's that alien word. It's that word that is not natural for God to speak, the way that he created natural order and this good and great creation that as it originally was. And the interesting thing here is it seems that Abraham is falling back on the promises of God, that he's a merciful God. And God mentions them here. He says, for I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him, which is that becoming a great and mighty nation, so that in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. And there's this tension here that we can't just let go slack or cut the line and go, well, we're just going to ignore God's one word or the other word and focus on just this one. I kind of see that at play here, is this alien word and the word of promise, the proper word that God speaks.
That's fantastic. I think it's a great insight, and I would echo the same. And I think, unfortunately, we're going to have to let that be the last word, because I think we're out of time.
This is true. I think that that's a great point. I think that there's no way to pray where you're not appealing to the mercies of God. Even if you might be asking for judgment, but just the fact that you're praying, just the fact that you are talking to God at all, is on some level done with the understanding that he's not going to like strike you dead for it. Just the very words of the Lord's Prayer at the very beginning, when you say "Our Father," you're acknowledging something. The fact that you can even say that is an act of mercy.
Every prayer is a confession that God is a God of love.
Yep. All right. Well, guys, go back over to ChristofFast.org. Check out the conference. Check out all the other stuff we got going on there. And check us out again next week. Hopefully next week, if nothing comes up. We're shooting for next week. And we will have another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. We will see you guys later.